Upon opening the package, he was surprised to find a note from Stevens and four smaller packages, one enclosing a lavender crystal, two filled with darkened metal specimens, and the last containing a half-inch triangle appearing to be an alloy of silver and gold. Vogel studied the samples in his hand and conducted elementary testing in his IBM laboratory. Except for its clarity and the beauty of its soft violet tinge, the amethyst crystal revealed no unusual properties. And the two metal specimens darkened by oxidation contained only small and impure quantities of aluminum and sulfur, with some silver, copper, and lead. But they held at least one surprise for him. When I touched the oxide with a stainless steel probe, Vogel later remembered, red streaks appeared and the oxide coating disappeared. I just touched the metal like that, and it started to deoxidize and become a pure metal. I've never seen a phenomenon like that before. It's just something that was unusual. Though the two darkened samples exhibited this unusual property, Vogel considered them no better than standard silver solder. You could have gone to a jeweler and gotten a specimen of that, he said. The other fragment that I had, the triangle, was different. In the separate packages, Vogel had found handwritten notes with information about each specimen. The note enclosed with the triangle said that when the Palladians gave it to Mir in 1975, Mir recorded in the contact notes that they had warned Earth scientists would easily be able to analyze the components of the alloy, which included the basic building blocks of the universe. But the alloy was bonded in a unique way involving seven separate development stages that by 20th century Earth technology would be impossible to duplicate. This information, one of them told Mir, can be only a suggestion to the Earth scientists for the still distant future. One evening, several days later, Vogel remained late at IBM to begin analyzing the burnished triangle. Placing the metal in the electron microscope, he turned on a videotape to record his analysis and peered through the lens. Though he had expected to encounter nothing new in the specimen, to his surprise he was looking at the most peculiar maze of elements he had ever seen. Since arriving in Tucson in 1966, Stevens had investigated cases for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, sometimes piloting a private plane to the sites. Though he was friends with Jim and Coral Lorenzen, who had founded APRO in 1952, he told them nothing of the Mir case for over a year. I didn't want them meddling in it yet, he said, because I didn't know where it was going. But after visiting the farm and talking to Mir in April 1978, he and Elders had discussed bringing APRO in on the case. The UFO organization had connections in the science community that might prove useful in having the evidence analyzed. So we decided to invite APRO to come into the case with us, said Elders. I really respected at that time the work they were doing, and so did Steve. They were the oldest and largest UFO group in the world, and they had a great reputation. They were dedicated, they had pioneered in a lot of areas. I liked Jim Lorenzen. And Jim was interested in the case, he seemed sincere. Lorenzen said later he had serious doubts about the case. But he would reserve judgment until the evidence had been examined by outside experts. For the present, he said, he considered Mir's photos to be art. They were exciting and interesting, he added, but we didn't consider them proof of anything. The alliance with APRA began with a basic misunderstanding. Lorenzen saw the gesture as an invitation to him to supervise the investigation so that the APRO stamp would make the efforts of Stevens and Intercept beyond question. I got involved in this with the idea it was to be an objective investigation and that I was to have control of the investigation, said Lorenzen. I would decide what tests would be done and what scientists and labs to use. Mostly, said Stevens. He asked questions about where I was on the investigation. Had I tested this? Had I looked at it this way or that way? Did I ask this or that question? The only inclination he gave me that he was sympathetic to it was that he said several times, there seems to be an awful lot here for one party to fake. Either it's a big group with a big scam, or something is going on. For a while Lorenzen met frequently with the investigators. He talked at length with the producer John Stefani and traveled to San Francisco to speak with Marcel Vogel, the scientist Delitoso had discovered at IBM. He met with representatives of a computer company that manufactured image processing equipment for analyzing photographs. But as time went on, Stevens held back on much of the evidence and information coming from the case. He did not want to lose control to Lorenzen. Furthermore, Delitoso was now digging into the science for them, and he had begun to establish his own contacts. They no longer needed APRO's connections in the science community. At the same time, Lorenzen had been speaking with other ufologists who had European contacts, and one of them passed on a rumor that the whole case was a big joke, that each time the Americans left Switzerland to return home, the Mias group laughed behind their backs at how easily they had been fooled. Lorenzen also heard that affidavits from alleged witnesses not only failed to support Mias' claims, but actually refuted them. "I think he used models," Lorenzen said later, "and he threw away those pictures that didn't turn out. See, they never checked out his avenues of developing and printing to see if they stood up. They never checked anything like that, which is one of the first things I would have checked." Lorenzen said that as far as he knew, no scientist ever analyzed the photographs. Then, over a year into the investigation, Lorenzen and Elders had a disagreement. Lorenzen asked if we would cover his expenses to Europe, said Elders. "At that time, we were using our own money, Intercept money, to cover our segment of the investigation. Wendell was using his retirement pay from the Air Force. So we were operating on the $10 a day through Europe program to save money to try to conduct the investigation. We told APRO no, we couldn't do it. APRO said, okay then, fine, we want all the evidence turned over to the APRO organization. Hell, who needs someone to help you under those conditions? So we said, thanks, but no thanks. Made them mad. We all finally agreed," Stevens admitted later, "that we wouldn't discuss the facts in the case anymore with anybody outside our group, and if anybody pressed for answers, try to get out of it, and if we couldn't get out of it, try to drag a hare across the trail and throw them off. It was probably not the best thing to do, but we were trying to keep people from stirring up bot at that time. We already were inside government laboratories, and we didn't need anybody else trying to help us get in there. Before 1978 scientists had used image processing exclusively to extract data from a photograph everyone knew was legitimate. A satellite had beamed it back from the Moon or Mars. It was real. The challenge with the Mir photos was to detect possible fabrication. Delitoso discovered the UFO group in Phoenix, Ground Saucer Watch, that claimed to have a reliable computer method for authenticating UFO photographs. Since 1974 they had received 500 photographs from around the world, subjected them to their new process, and pronounced a large majority hoaxes. A few, less than 5%, they proclaimed to be genuine. Unknown to Delitoso, a West German researcher had sent 10 Mir photos to GSW for analysis 2 years earlier. After analyzing the photos, GSW had reported, "All of the pictures are hoaxes and they should not be considered evidence of an extraordinary flying craft." Nearly every method of photo fakery possible had allegedly been employed by the one-armed Mir, a suspended model, the double exposure technique, the double print method. The West German UFO group had immediately ceased their investigation of the Mir case. Later, Ground Saucer Watch had received a photograph of a disc-shaped craft taken by a man in Calgary, Canada. They analyzed the photograph and found it to be genuine, which they announced publicly. Sometime later, through an intermediary, the man from Calgary sent a second photograph he had taken of the same disc on the same roll of film. GSW concluded that the photo depicts the crudest attempt at a hoax that we have ever seen. Since that blatant contradiction was publicized, few people had given weight to the findings of the organization. In his research of equipment and procedures, Delitoso learned that GSW performed none of the alleged computer work. They sent all photographs to a firm in California, where technicians entered them into a computer by taking another picture with an inexpensive video camera, and applied basic software programs to enhance the photographs with bright colors. Then they took another picture off the computer screen and sent these pictures back to GSW to be studied with the naked eye. By then, the information in the original photograph had been greatly distorted. This frustrated Jim, said Welch. It frustrated Steve and me. Because there was no structured approach. They could have been looking at stuff that came from a dirty lens. Or, said Dilatoso, the angle of the light on the photo could be wrong and create surface reflection from the gloss on the picture. There's 100 things that could happen. I spent a lot of time talking to GSW and found I wasn't going to get anything out of them. They really were playing with toys. After GSW, it took Dilatoso little time to discover the father of image processing, Dr. Robert Nathan at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Dr. Nathan had conceived image processing in the 1960s and developed it for nearly 20 years. Although other government labs now had comparable equipment, as well as scientists competent in image processing, JPL was considered first in the field. After several calls from Dilatoso and Stevens over a period of months, Nathan finally agreed to look at the photos, but he would not commit himself to examining them. The procedure was costly and time-consuming, and though Nathan's job was to detect and analyze objects in space, whatever their nature, he had no time to waste. Still, he kept an open mind. In his office, before even viewing the photographs, Nathan told Stevens and Dilatoso he would look at the photos as an individual, not as a scientist at JPL, and that any opinion he rendered would be his own, not that of the NASA facility. That made clear, Stevens pulled out several 11x14 prints he had made of MIA photos and laid them on Nathan's desk. The scientist perused them, saying nothing. Then he reached for the phone and called the photo lab to tell them he was coming over. After looking at the photos for a few more minutes, he escorted Stevens and Dilatoso to the lab to have copies made of a set of transparencies also in Stevens's possession. We took the internegatives that I had to their processing facility, recalled Stevens. And they made copies from those. They wanted to keep the internegatives, but we wouldn't let them, because every time somebody has kept one they end up talking with it in front of them and little spitballs fall on it, and when you put it under super magnification the next time you've got little blues in the picture. Bob Post, the head of the photo lab where every JPL photo of planets, stars, asteroids, and comets was processed and printed, had worked there for 22 years. Over the years of looking at photographs and judging photographs, he said, you get to the point where you can see a lot of things in a photograph that the average person doesn't see. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Nathan entered the lab and showed the large prints to Post. I'd seen pictures of UFOs before, said Post, and I looked at them as a bunch of bull. There's no definition to anything. But these were good. Whatever they were good. You've got a nice spacecraft sitting there, you've got some good ground out here, you've got a sky with clouds in it once in a while, and you can see some detail. The pictures look good. Under further scrutiny you might find out, yeah, they're fake. But some of his pictures I thought were gorgeous, absolutely the best stuff I've ever seen for UFO pictures. From a photography standpoint, you couldn't see anything that was fake about them. That's what struck me. They looked like legitimate photographs. I thought, God, if this is real, this is going to be really something. Nathan reserved judgment. By the summer of 1979, the elders, Welch, and Stevens had spent over $30,000 traveling to Switzerland to see MIA, traveling to San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other locales to speak with scientists and computer companies, and telephoning all over the United States. With Dilatoso beginning to open doors at major laboratories, they decided they needed more money if they were to continue investigating the case properly. A few scientists had conducted preliminary tests on some of the evidence, and so far they were getting interesting results, but nothing conclusive as yet. Without consulting Lorenzen further, Intercept formed Genesis 3 Publishing and produced UFO Contact from the Pleiades, a large-format photo journal containing many of the MIA photos, a sampling of quotes by Sam Jays, a brief outline of Mia's experiences since 1975, astronomical and mythological information on the Pleiades, and some of the preliminary findings on the testing of the evidence. Sort of the mix of what we had done up to that point, said Elders. 71 pages long, the Pleiades book claimed that a number of scientists had been consulted on the Mir evidence and that some now were conducting a most exhaustive and painstakingly detailed investigation. But the text mentioned no names. The book displayed pictures of various people sitting around a table in the Mir kitchen and noted there were a substantial number of local witnesses who had personally observed these remarkable events, though it identified no one in the pictures. The book informed that scientists were analyzing the Mir photos more thoroughly than any UFO photos had ever been analyzed, utilizing additional, highly advanced procedures and technology drawn from sophisticated aerospace and nuclear medicine applications, but it included no signed reports or statements from the scientists. Near the end of the book was one page comprised of two short paragraphs entitled Metal Samples Analysis. The first paragraph claimed, from the beginning, unique qualities in the metal samples were detected. But the text referred to those who had performed the analysis only as the scientists involved. Then it claimed that these scientists had never seen anything like it before, and that these detailed analyses continue today. The text failed to divulge even one source, yet the writing abounded in hyperbole. Elders' earlier refusal to release any of the evidence to the UFO community had caused considerable controversy over the Mir case months before publication of the photo journal. Many ufologists thought Mir's claims of having traveled in space and time were outlandish. They laughed when he said that a tree in a photograph had later disappeared because some jays had erased its time, and reports constantly drifted back from Europe that someone had seen small models hanging in Mir's barn, with intercepts extravagant claims now public and totally unsupported in the text of the photo journal. Accusations from the UFO community increased and became more heated. While pretty to look at, alleged the kinder criticism, the pictures, and whatever other evidence the elders and their group claimed to have, represented no proof of anything. Harsher critics screamed fraud. Mutual UFO Network director Walt Andrus wrote in 1980 in the MUFON UFO Journal that the photo book produced by the Intercept Group is an outright fraud perpetrated upon the public for financial gain. He added, a U.S. investigation had identified a balloon in several of the photographs that supports the model on a string while Billy Mir, with one arm operating his camera, moves through several different angles. Andrus lamented even mentioning the photo journal in his group's publication. However, he wrote, it is imperative that such opportunists be exposed. A 1980 book review in Fate magazine concluded, I think this book is nonsense, handsomely packaged, to be sure, but nonsense all the same. The reviewer, George Early, later wrote in a spring 1981 edition of a UFO newsletter called Saucer Smear that what Stevens offered as proof was cheap twaddle. Stevens well knows what constitutes legal and/or scientific proof here on planet Earth, he continued, but he and his compatriots have consistently and persistently failed to provide any such proof. Until they do, they deserve every bit of criticism sent their way by the rest of us. In the fall of 1979, Jim Lorenzen, who had had more exposure to the evidence than anyone outside the Intercept Group, told the audience gathered at UFO 79, the APRO convention in San Diego, my present disposition is that the Mir case is a hoax. Then he paused and added, it's not that simple though. Some aspects of the case and some of the evidence presented, he felt, were very difficult to explain. But too often Mir's inflated claims required Lorenzen to suspend common sense. He accused Stevens and the Intercept Group of going to Mir as skeptics and as investigators but becoming disciples spreading the word. Part of it, I would say, is mysterious and I can't account for it, he concluded, but that doesn't mean I have to buy the whole package. In the April Bulletin of October 1979, Lorenzen's words were more pointed. Addressing Stevens he wrote, I submit, seriously, that you and your associates have rushed to judgment on this matter because of a strong will to believe, a predisposition toward exotic explanations. So far, each instance of evidence that Mir has offered, when pursued to its logical limit, ends up being a zero as far as compelling proof is concerned. Add any number of zeros and you still have zero. One ufologist, Lucius Farish, a columnist for the MUFON UFO Journal, publicly defended Stevens in the Intercept group. You are free to think anything you wish concerning the Mir case or Stevens's investigation of it, he wrote to the journal's editor. However, the fact remains that you have no proof that the case is a hoax. I've heard all kinds of accusations, but I have yet to see one iota of real evidence. When anyone takes thousands of dollars out of his own pocket to investigate UFOs, I think he deserves to be heard without a bunch of clowns harassing him because he showed them up at their own game. Later, in a letter to another ufologist, Carl Korff, who more than anyone else had repeatedly attacked the Mir case, Farish wrote, "The opinions of persons who have never bothered to investigate the case and who are willing to accept negative statements concerning it without investigation are totally worthless. I would say that 98% of the criticisms of the Mir case which I have read, heard are merely sour grapes." In the MUFON UFO Journal of December 1980, Korff published an article entitled "The Mir Incident, the Most Infamous Hoax in Ufology," which he later expanded into a booklet and distributed among other ufologists. Korff concluded, "After a careful review of all of the major purported events as stated by Genesis 3 and those individuals involved with the Mir case, it can be conclusively shown that none of the events as claimed contain the slightest shred of evidence to support their authenticity. Therefore, it must be stated that the Mir case gives every appearance of being nothing more than a grandiose and elaborate hoax. It is certainly the most extravagant of all of the known contactee cases contained within the records of ufology." At UFO 79 in San Diego, remembered Lee Elders, "The character assassination started against us. They started attacks that were unbelievable. They sent out flyers and brochures talking about this Mir hoax that we had perpetrated. We went through a bloody mess for a year and a half after that, so we quietly rallied our forces together. We're being attacked day and night for perpetrating the wildest hoax since time began, and we can't lay this card on the table with IBM or any of the other labs. We don't want people bothering the scientists. So at that point we refused to release any more information on the case. We took it underground, and this haunted me for 2 years. I felt we had tangible evidence as an investigator. I didn't know if we could prove the case to be real, but I knew we had tangible evidence. Not one of these UFO people had ever been to Switzerland. They hadn't spent 5 minutes with Mir. None of them has been there. So how can they say it's a hoax? That's what frustrated me the most." Then, added Britt, "letters started coming in here saying, 'We want to see what you have. Send it to us.' We wrote back saying, 'No. If you want to see what we have, you come to Phoenix and look at it. It does not leave our possession.' So then everybody starts saying, 'They don't have anything. They're not going to let anyone see what they have because they don't have anything at all.' That's how this little merry-go-round works. I said, 'It's here, but if you want to see it you come here to see it.' None of them ever did." While Dilatoso conducted his campaign with the scientists, Lee Elders returned from Switzerland with a new sound tape from Mir. Eva Beery, one of the witnesses present when the sounds were recorded, had described to Elders the experience of listening to the sounds as a beam ship, unseen, hovered overhead. An attractive Swiss woman in her mid-twenties, Eva had stood in a meadow only 2 miles from the farm, balancing her 2-month-old son on her hip. Popeye, a tape recorder in her hand, stood nearby. Near the edge of a pine forest 200 to 300 yards away, Mir had sat on his tractor, as another tape recorder turned in the small trailer behind it. Soon, Engelbert and Maria Wachter and others had joined them, and then everyone had watched the sky and waited. Eva, who had sensitive ears, disliked loud music and loud people. But when the deafening sounds suddenly filled the sky over her, She became angry not for her own discomfort, but because she felt it would harm the ears of her baby. "On tape it sounds different than it really was," she said. "It was like the sky was full of sound, not from one place. The sound was everywhere, and we were thinking it must be very loud because people came from far away to see what had happened, and they were running, not walking. Shrill and unnatural, seeming to echo from within as it rose and fell, the sound, though loud, seemed almost pleasant to Eva's ears." Her child did not cry, but only craned his neck and blinked his eyes and listened. For years Delitoso had worked at creating sound using digital sound synthesizers, whereas analyzing photos involved techniques new to him. He understood the analysis of sound. Through a former employer, Mocha Corporation, he arranged one evening to examine the recording with a digital audio analyzer. But after taking the sounds apart, he could not figure out how to duplicate them. "That was the point at which I was blown away," he said. "To the ear they don't sound that unusual. It sounds like what you'd expect a sci-fi flying saucer to sound like. But upon analysis, they're continually shifting and changing, and combinations of them are getting louder and softer and doing things at such a rapid rate that even with a synthesizer being able to generate that many sounds, it would be really, really complex." But needing independent verification, Delitoso sent the tape to Rob Shellman, a sound engineer with the United States Navy Sonar Sound Laboratory in Groton, Connecticut. Also intrigued with their complexity, Shellman immediately eliminated one major possibility: Mia could not have used any electrical AC source to create the sounds. The equipment was set up to analyze for 50 or 60 Hz UTE frequencies, which are common electrical outlets. Shellman wrote to Delitoso. "If the device that generates the sound was an electric motor or machine, the line frequencies would be evident. No such frequencies were detected." Seeking further verification of what seemed to be an unusual recording, Stevens located in Los Angeles an electronics consultant and computer engineer, Nils Rognerud. A designer with a large electronics firm, Rognerud took the tape to a sound lab and converted the sounds to wavy lines on a spectrum analyzer. As he watched, the various frequencies vibrated up and down across the screen, converged into a thick zigzag, then split apart and converged again. "I was being very skeptical from a scientific viewpoint," Rognerud said later, "but the sounds were unusual." At a loss to explain them, Rognerud called in a second consultant, Steve Ambrose, who built custom microphones for rock stars and was the sound engineer for Stevie Wonder. Recently, Ambrose had built a tiny wireless radio receiver and speaker that fit inside Stevie Wonder's ear. The radio, called a micromonitor, was one of two inventions Ambrose had patented. He also toured regularly with Simon and Garfunkel, Engelbert Humperdinck, Diana Ross, and other popular singers as a sound specialist. He understood sound synthesizers and their capabilities. Rognerud had asked him to listen to the Mia recording to see if he thought Mia somehow had fabricated the sounds with a synthesizer. Later Ambrose said, "Nils knew that if I thought it was a hoax, I would just flatly say, 'I'm sorry, I could do this.' He's like that, too." Over the phone, Rognerud explained to Ambrose that the alleged source of the sounds was an interstellar beam ship coming to Earth from the Pleiades. He added that from everything he could discern, the sounds seemed to be authentic. Such a strong endorsement from Rognerud piqued Ambrose's interest, but the recording still held surprises for him. After listening to it a while and watching it on the spectrum analyzer, he told Rognerud the sounds could not possibly have been made with a synthesizer. They were analog, or natural, sounds, and he agreed with Rognerud that they seemed authentic. "If someone is perpetrating a hoax," he said, "they went to some length. Synthesizers use oscillators that are capable of making things that sound real," Ambrose explained later. "But the frequencies that this sound generated were so random and varied it was beyond the capabilities of an oscillator or even a group of oscillators. You'd have to use a microphone of some analog, natural sound like a lathe, metal cutting metal, which has low frequencies and high frequencies. And if you speeded it up or slowed it down, you could get the various frequencies that would resemble what this had on it. But even then you'd have to take that and layer it several times, mixing one sound in with another, and this just didn't sound like something that had been layered, track upon track upon track. When you've dealt with recording and electronic sound, you get to be able to hear what happens when you layer one sound on top of another. This was a single sound source recording that had an amazing frequency response.